Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. A man we turn to with regularity is an expert on those enemies, foreign and domestic. In fact, he is a man who, I would argue, was once among them as a Marxist professor at New York University. To his credit, and to our great benefit, he realized he was on the wrong team, and he's joined those who love freedom, and he's become a very vocal, very informed, very courageous champion of ours here in the United States. His name is Dr. Michael Rechtenwald. He is the author of a number of important books that address various aspects of these problems, including Thought Criminal and The Google Archipelago, and most recently, The Great Reset and The Struggle for Liberty, Unraveling the Global Agenda. It's always a distinct privilege to have a chance to visit with him, and we're delighted to do so today. Michael Rechtenwald, welcome back to Securing America, sir.
Hi, Frank. Great to be here.
Thank you. Let me ask you first and foremost, Michael. There is a community of people. You have called them elitists. They are global in character, for sure. They have different sort of ideological tenets that animate them, the Chinese Communist Party being prominent among them, the Islamists, I would argue, Sharia supremacists also have their own strain. And then there are the great resetters of World Economic Forum notoriety and the like. What they all seem to have in common, despite sort of different end states, I guess you might say, is a commitment to take us down. Talk about that and the extent to which that is indeed something that is now causing them to join forces against us and the danger that it represents.
Yeah, that's a great point. So the global elites are centered around the UN and the World Economic Forum and a number of other globalist organizations are very much against national sovereignty. And they see the United States as the particular impediment to the global order that they want to establish. This is no secret. And they've made it very clear. They've stated this point blank. They have allied with the Chinese Communist Party. In fact, the World Economic Forum has regular forums on the China question and China itself and what China's role is in the world. And
well, I think they actually meet there.
They meet
every
there.
Year, don't they? Yeah, it's yes. Davos is where they're generally figured as being, but they also are meeting annually in China. So this is not an accident. This is very much something that they cultivate, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, they've been looking at China as the model for the world for some time, since going all the way back to the early 70s, where Maurice Strong, who was Klaus Schwab's mentor and Canadian environmentalist, basically formally stated that China is the model for the West and that they were the ideal in terms of how they dealt with their economic system and also their political system.
Wow.
And the relationship between the state and the public. Yeah.
This happens to be the view of the Chinese Communist Party as well, doesn't it?
Right.
their model ought to apply universally.
Yes.
So, Michael, talk a little bit more about this. The elite, whether it's captured by the Chinese Communist Party, whether it's simply aligned with it, whether it's, regarding the Chinese as the perfect model or just looking at the United States as the absolute impediment. The kind of collaboration that you're seeing to effect our takedown, again, you know the playbook. Talk us through how they're doing it, not just overseas, but here as well.
Well, one of the main things that they're doing is trying to debase our economic structures and deindustrialize us to a great extent while abetting China. And actually, interestingly enough, you know, they're using climate change as the main pretext for this. And they're praising China for China's compliance and leadership in climate change mitigation, whereas China is the greatest emitter of so-called greenhouse gases in the world by far and has no intention of doing anything to curb it. In fact, they're bringing on more coal facilities every day. So this is ridiculous. It's ludicrous. So they're using this climate pretext to weaken us and lie about China. They literally say China's the leader, but China's the leader in the wrong direction if their direction is true. So, I mean, it's a complete fabrication here that's used as a pretext to dissolve our industry, our power, our ability to have energy and our farming. It's just unbelievable what they're attempting to do.
It's a wrecking operation, I think, pretty much across the board. And Michael, to the extent that it not only is, well, lying and certainly deeply cynical and hypocritical, but it's also strengthening China in the process. Among other things, it is, as you know so well, creating and further helping consolidate the supply chains from China.
Absolutely.
Upon which the rest of the world is so dependent, especially us at this point. That's not an accident either, is it, comrade?
No, I mean, it's incredible. This ESG index, for example, is greatly benefiting China because their compliance is completely fabricated. The state
compliance with that environment, social governance, yes, agenda.
Compliance with the ESG is completely fabricated, and it's strengthening their hand in terms of our dependence upon them. In particular, you know, for example, the whole EV industry, the electric vehicle industry, is utterly benefiting China because they're the ones that have the minerals. And they're the ones that are able to export those minerals. And so all of this is debasing the U.S. and greatly accreting to China's economic power. And what goes along with China's economic power is its ideological and political power. And that's what they use the economic for. It's not the end game in itself. It's the first step toward the ideological hegemony that they wish to attain. It's the way they go about getting that ideological hegemony. And that's exactly what's afoot.
Dr. Recktenwell, I want to ask you, both as a serious student of these kinds of ideological forces and agendas, as well as a former subscriber to them, about one particular point, and that is when you talk about essentially the help that these folks are giving the Chinese Communist Party in their unrestricted warfare against us, to what extent is there a calculation that they themselves will benefit from the new outcomes? We're going to talk about that and much more with Dr. Michael Recktenwell on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute, British wit Samuel Johnson described second marriages as, quote, the triumph of hope over experience, unquote. So is Wall Street's enthusiasm for sinking billions more of our money in Chinese communist e-commerce conglomerate Alibaba. After all, the company is a case study in the dangers of investing in China. Its founder, Jack Ma, ran afoul of Chinese dictator Xi Jinping, and his company was punished, resulting in a dramatic and protracted loss in share value. There is no guarantee that similar non-market forces won't adversely impact U.S. investors in companies like Alibaba in the future. The larger problem, however, for Americans whose pension funds or other investments have been sunk in Chinese corporations is that, in the event of the shooting war that Xi seems intent on launching, they will lose every cent. U.S. investors must divest from communist China while they still can. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and we're continuing our conversation with one of the men I admire most, not least because of the fundamental transformation, you might say, he has undergone, both in terms of his own personal thinking and the causes that he advocates. And today, he is all about freedom. And among other things, he has written a powerful new book on the subject. It's called The Great Reset and the Struggle for Freedom. And I couldn't be more pleased to have a chance to talk again with Dr. Michael Rechtenwald about it and related subjects. And Doctor, you were telling us before the break about the extent to which these global elites, who are not, strictly speaking, Chinese communists, but very much enamored of them and helping them, including through various means of the kind of warfare the Chinese have long waged against us, unrestricted warfare, economic, political, ideological, subversion, and so on. I'm always curious as to whether, as a man who knows, you know, how the radical left views those who are, well, I think they call them useful idiots, how they're likely to be treated in the event that the Chinese communists succeed in achieving the kind of, global governance, as they like to call it under Xi, that would put them on top and have everybody else enslaved.
Yeah, I think that they imagine they would be participating with this, or that, in fact, they would be directing it and China would be some kind of a compliant partner in it. And, you know, China's the model, but they don't realize that they're modeling them, the model that they're erecting would have them eliminated in effect. So it would
maybe not just in effect, maybe very literally. Physically.
It might be very literally too.
Yeah,
yes.
That's kind of the tradition, I think.
I would think that what the Chinese would look at, the Chinese Communist Party, Xi and his comrades would look at these World Economic Forum people as utter dupes. And they would, in the UN as well, they would look at them as something to be swept out of the way once they get into power globally, if that's what they're, and that is their agenda, of course.
That is their agenda. And you know, they'll be used in the meantime, to be sure, and are.
Oh, yeah.
But they will be dispensable when they're no longer needed. This brings me to a very specific application of this global elitist business and some of the very organizations that you're talking about, Doctor, that are clearly now in the service of the Chinese Communist Party, and that would be the World Health Organization. The Chinese personally or corporately selected Tedros Ghebreyesus as the Director General of the World Health Organization, and then they got him reelected subsequently to a second 5-year term, despite in the interval having largely aided and abetted the Chinese Communist Party's, well, unbelievably destructive Wuhan virus-driven pandemic. But that's not the end of it. they now seek, the Chinese communists and these global elites, to greatly enhance the power of the World Health Organization, also known as the WHO, from an advisory body to one that would actually be authorized to compel nations to address, as they see fit, so-called public health crises, emergencies of international concern. What do you make of what's going on here, and how does that fit into this larger strategy you're talking about on the part of the CCP on the one hand and the global resetters on the other?
Yes, I mean, the UN has been aiming at this kind of control for some time, and now they're using the pandemic as a pretext, the previous pandemic as a pretext for creating a treaty that all the member nations would sign, which in effect would surrender their sovereignty over behavior with reference to health emergencies altogether, which then are then at the discretion of the WHO to declare. It's a very frightening prospect. So, yes, the Chinese have got control over the WHO, despite the fact that we're paying for them. They're able to use the WHO as an instrument for world domination. And this is really what it is. They're using the WHO as a proxy weapon to enslave humanity with this treaty. And unfortunately, a bill was just rejected that would have made it necessary to have the Senate approve any such treaties. And now that is apparently not going to be the case. So we'll see what's going on here in terms of this treaty. If it does get put into force, we've got a heap of trouble.
Well, we do indeed. And just to put a fine point on it, there's actually two different agreements that the World Health Organization is working on. As you know, one is this treaty on pandemics, as they call it, though they don't want to treat it as a treaty, hence this rejection by the Senate of the advice and consent responsibilities given to it uniquely by the Constitution of the United States. Then there's this other agreement that just changes the existing international health regulations, either one of which, let alone both of them, will put us in a heap of trouble, as you say, because fundamentally they will use, and this is one of the things I wanted to just visit with you about, sir, because you have a background in this. They would use public concerns about safety and health to justify the imposition of tyranny. Mm-hmm. And, don't take our word for it. This is not speculation. This is not a euphemism. This is what happened to us in this recent pandemic, is it not?
Yes.
And is this not just part of the classic playbook of totalitarians to effect this kind of fundamental transformation, as they say?
Yes. I mean, C.S. Lewis put it really well. There's no worse tyranny than that which is effected supposedly for our own good. And that's exactly what they're using as the pretext for this tyranny.
Somebody called to mind the pattern that began perhaps maybe earlier, but certainly in the French Revolution, long before Marx and company, of using this so-called Committee of Public Safety, which became the engine for, the guillotine and the annihilation of many, many Frenchmen, to affect the public well-being, as you say. And it's terrifying. As is this idea that we could relinquish our sovereign control over public health to these unaccountable bureaucrats working for the global resetters, using one of their specific pet projects, as you know, which is global identification cards, to achieve a level of control over the populations, both of this country and others, unprecedented in world history. I mean, modeled again after the Chinese social credit system. No?
Yeah. Yep, the digital identity, global digital identity would be a part and parcel of this. And it is, I think, one of the most pernicious, if not the most pernicious and liberty destroying technologies ever introduced. So that's, I write about this in the great, in the book, The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty.
Yeah, and I think your Google Archipelago gets into it in some detail as well. And the point is that it doesn't have to happen to us, folks. And so we are, I hope, working with Dr. Michael Rechtenwald and many others to oppose the continued participation of the United States and the World Health Organization. And we're going to be talking much more about a new initiative on that subject a little later this week. So stay tuned and be prepared to get engaged to protect our sovereignty against the World Health Organization gambit of the Chinese Communist Party and the Global Resetters. Check out Michael Rechtenwald's terrific book on this, The Great Reset and the Struggle for Liberty. Thank you for joining us, sir. Come back to us again soon if you would. We'll be right back with George Raceley and more right after this.
Night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and it's one of the high points of our week when we get to visit with George Raceley, our resident genius, we're fond of pointing out here, immense, identified, certified, credentialed genius. He is, among other things, ingeniously editing Richard Viguerie's marvelous online web platform called Conservative HQ. It's required reading. Commended to all of you. He is also a man who knows his way around the political space, having served in some 300 campaigns over the years, including some at the presidential level. He's worked on the Hill. He's worked in the vice president's office. He is a go-to guy for us on just about everything. So welcome back once again, George Raceley. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank.
We talked a little bit in the previous segment with Dr. Michael Rechtenwald about a matter that I know you've written about at Conservative HQ, involving the impending surrender of our sovereignty to an organization called the WHO, the World Health Organization. Just remind us of how serious a threat this is, as you see it, to, well, not just our sovereignty as a nation, but to our personal health and well-being as well.
Well, the WHO is dominated by the Red Chinese. They're the ones that got, you know, its head elected. It's a, you know, function of the WHO to, in essence, override the sovereign decisions of its members on things like pandemic responses. And this agreement that Biden is, you know, entered into.
Well, he's negotiating at this point.
Yeah, well, he's prepared to enter into is the correct way to say it, is completely inimical to our constitutional order. He doesn't intend to submit it to the Senate as a treaty. If they do get Congress to sign off on it, it'll be through some backdoor means, anti-constitutional means, like they did with the Iran bomb deal. And so it's,
and they may not even go through the motions of that. The Senate, as Michael Recktenwald pointed out just last week, said, "No, you don't need to bring it to us."
Yeah, well, typical of the Schumer Senate. And so, you know, consequently, these Chinese influenced bureaucrats will be telling you what to do, and it will, in essence, have the force of the law in the United States.
I would say that's a significant problem and one that must be fought.
Yes.
Look forward to doing so with you and Richard Viguerie's help. Let me ask you, if I can, about another matter that you've also been writing about recently, George, that's very much on my heart. As you know, we have an organization we call Save the Persecuted Christians. Mm-hmm. Six of them were murdered last week in Nashville, Tennessee, by someone whose mental health condition is now described as transgender. What do you think this says, not only about that particular individual, but also perhaps about the intensifying persecution of Christians in this country?
Well, it should be extremely concerning to every believing Christians in America, and also anyone else, whether Jewish, Muslim, whatever, who believes in religious freedom and liberty. The transgender ideology is the, sworn enemy, if you will, of Judeo-Christian values. It purports to have science, in essence, become God, to recreate individual humans in whatever image they choose for themselves. And as a consequence, the Christian, Judeo-Christian mores, monogamy
family.
Family, you name it, are all the, in essence, the enemies of transgender ideology. And
among other things, the idea that we're created in the image of God as,
yeah,
man and woman. But George, you choose your words very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
Until very recently, I was unaware, honestly, that there was any such thing as transgenderism, let alone that it actually has an ideological underpinning to it.
Oh, yeah.
Is that the case, or is it just sort of what's implicit in this idea that you can decide whatever you are, irrespective of whatever?
Oh, no,
there is a
Marxist-influenced ideology behind this. And it is got a serious revolutionary component. It has its enemies list, with Christians and practicing Jews being at the top of the list, because of their strong aversion to, moral underpinnings of their religions that oppose homosexuality and this whole idea that one can change their gender at their whim. And if you look at, for example, the arrest reports of Antifa revolutionaries, you will find a good number of alleged transgender individuals among them. And there is an ideological component there. And Christians practicing Jews are the natural enemies of transgenderism.
So, George, I guess the bottom line of this is that when one hears of this event, the fact that the Christians being targeted, let alone the impetus that was operating for the individual shooter, got scarcely any mention at all in the mainstream press is, again, not an accident.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, that explains why this individual's manifesto has never been released, because although I'm speculating, based on social media information, it's pretty clear that the basis for this attack was fury against what was taught at that school.
That this individual apparently attended at some point along the trail.
Yeah.
And I guess part of the theory is that, you know, Christians are opposed to the gender mutilation and the other, you know, particularly aimed at children, barbaric practices, and therefore that justifies some of this targeting. What was going to be a day of vengeance was transformed into a day of visibility, notwithstanding. George, let me finally turn to one other topic. We'll get into it a little bit more in a moment with Bill Walton, but I wanted to just get your take on it, too. This Chinese Communist Party phone app called TikTok is much in the news these days, because I think more and more Americans are realizing, despite its wild popularity, particularly with young people, notably because of its addictiveness by design, that it is a real problem for the individuals involved and for the national security as well. There's an effort underway now to try to ban TikTok, but you've also indicated that you think there's some real problems with that idea as well, or at least how it's being executed.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, typical of our modern Congress that everything looks like a nail, so it needs to be cured with a hammer. And the Restrict Act, maybe in its original conception, was possibly a good idea, but the way it's written right now is that it gives the government the power to ban any website or app that it doesn't like. And so they, under the bill as written, sponsored by Democrat Senator Warner from Virginia, the government could decide it doesn't like conservative HQ because we criticize the government, whether it's run by Republicans or Democrats, pretty regularly. And so we could be banned. Even though I would argue that our criticisms are intended to turn the government back to its constitutional limits and responsibilities. Whereas TikTok's, the biggest problem in addition to its addictive nature is that it dumps vast quantities of information back to Red China. And that could be used in all sorts of ways. It's also possible that there are means within TikTok to access data that's not part of that which is needed to operate the app. And so if you
like your phone and the microphone on
if you have TikTok on your phone and you carry it into the Pentagon, it could be dumping everything that is collected there back to Red China.
George, there's so much more to talk about in all of this. We are out of time, unfortunately, but I did want to just say that I think banning TikTok and other apps, there's a new one that we'll talk about with Bill more called Pin Duo, that is also problematic due to malware that the Chinese have put on it. But we do need to do it in an appropriate way, and clearly not as a means of, putting, to use your analogy, the last nail in the coffin of our freedoms. We'll talk with you more about all of this, my friend. In the meantime, thanks for the great work you do at Conservative HQ. I know you'll keep it up. Come back to us soon. We'll be right back with more with Bill Walton right after this.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. British wit Samuel Johnson described second marriages as, quote, the triumph of hope over experience, unquote. So is Wall Street's enthusiasm for sinking billions more of our money in Chinese communist e-commerce conglomerate Alibaba. After all, the company is a case study in the dangers of investing in China. Its founder, Jack Ma, ran afoul of Chinese dictator Xi Jinping, and his company was punished, resulting in a dramatic and protracted loss in share value. There is no guarantee that similar non-market forces won't adversely impact U.S. investors in companies like Alibaba in the future. The larger problem, however, for Americans whose pension funds or other investments have been sunk in Chinese corporations is that, in the event of the shooting war that Xi seems intent on launching, they will lose every cent. U.S. investors must divest from communist China while they still can. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. It's that time of the week, I'm happy to say, when we feature Bill Walton, star and driving force behind a terrific TV podcast program called The Bill Walton Show. He brings to this experience, as well as to ours, the wisdom of a man who had spent a good bit of his life on Wall Street, including as the CEO of a $6 billion enterprise called Allied Capital. He is these days a very astute observer from sort of a conservative public policy perspective of developments around the world. And we're always anxious to catch up with him to make sense of particularly the economic and financial dimensions thereof. Bill, for all of that, welcome back. It's good to have you with us, sir.
Frank, great talking with you.
Pleasure. Let me start by asking you to work through with us, Bill, what seems to be growing pressure on the reserve status of the dollar, the reserve currency status of the dollar, notably as a result of Chinese machinations with Saudi Arabia and Iraq in recent weeks that have agreed to buy, or rather sell to China, China being the buyer, oil and gas in renminbi rather than dollars. What's up with that? And is it a problem, do you think, for the reserve status of the dollar?
Well, there are two very interrelated big topics. One is the U.S. dollar status as a global reserve currency, and the other one is the dollar status as the petrocurrency, aka the petrodollar. And both there are headlines in both cases about the U.S. dominance beginning to weaken. The thing to keep in mind about the U.S. dollar is that its status as a reserve currency has been there for decades and decades, but it's fluctuated. Right now, it's about 58%. It actually fell as low as 46% in 1991.
I'm sorry, 58 or 46%
I'm sorry,
of what?
46% from 58 to 46.
Of what?
46% of the world's traded of the reserve currencies. Right now, we're at about 58%. The euro's about 20%. I think coming up next would be the British pound at about 6%, the Japanese yen at about 6%, and then the Chinese yuan's around... 2.5-3% now. So it's a percentage of the world's reserve currencies, and it got clobbered back in the early 90s when inflation was raging in the United States, and when Paul Volcker came back in, its status as a reserve currency bounced back up. Then the euro got introduced, and that challenged the U.S. dominance, but then the euro banking system and the whole economic arrangement in Europe proved a lot more fragile than people had expected, and so it lost its status. So the dollar's hung in there despite our massive trade deficits and our government deficit, fiscal deficits.
But I guess, Bill, the question is there now a correlation of forces developing between the Chinese and the Russians, who are obviously now thick as thieves, as well as this so-called BRICS group, Brazil, China, India, Russia, and South Africa, which seems to be getting more adherence with each passing day. At what point do you think does this achieve a sort of critical mass and the dollar status, especially as you say, with our running up of our deficits, become truly imperiled? And also, Bill, what are the implications of that for the layperson if it does?
Well, the reality is that the currencies depend an awful lot on the size of the economies involved, and the U.S. is still 20-25% of the world economy, neck and neck with China. And China could have a reserve currency, but all of its policies, all of its secrecy, all of its restrictions on free trading in its currency make it impossible to hold as a reserve currency. You just can't trust the Chinese Communist Party. So that's keeping it down at 2-2.5%. So regardless of the deals the Chinese might make with Russia, say to buy oil from Russia, that's going to be a drop in the ocean in terms of where the petro money is traded. The thing you need to keep in mind that with the petro the oil business, there's also a massive derivatives market behind that, and the derivatives market requires trillions of dollars to back up and to provide liquid trading. So I guess the short answer for the lay investor is I see the dollar's reserve status staying fairly dominant for the foreseeable future. And it's not because we're doing such a great job. It's because all the other countries are doing a terrible job.
Yeah, there's the expression, I think, on Wall Street that we're the least dirty shirt in a very nasty pile of laundry.
It's a nasty pile.
Yeah. And I guess, Bill, that's really good news, because if we were to lose the reserve status of the dollar, what would be the knock-on effects of that for, again, just average Americans?
Well, the if we lost our reserve currency status, the dollar did, it would be a massive blow. We couldn't finance our deficit, which I guess our debt now is at about $33 trillion and rising. Some projections, I talked with Steve Moore last week, have us at about $50 billion in 6 or 7 years.
Trillion.
Sorry, yeah. Again, another Edward.
Hard to get
Edward
your head
Berkson
around
moment,
that.
Billion here, billion there, and then it becomes a trillion.
Real money. Yeah.
So it would be catastrophic, but I think we're a long ways off from that. What is more concerning, though, if you look at the debt that we're piling up, is the interest on that debt is rising ominously. And we've seen rates, short-term rates have risen from close to zero to 4.5-5% in just the last 12 months. It's one of the fastest rises on record. That's going to
And when that happens, we wind up having to pay that instead of having discretionary funding for most other things, including our national defense, Bill. We have to take a short break. We're going to come right back to this and much more with Bill Walton. We're going to talk also about the advisability of investing your money in communist China in a very murky time. We'll be right back with more after this. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Bill Walton is with us virtually. We're always delighted to have him in the house. He is, among other things, a guy following closely what is happening. And a question that we often ask him is whether it is advisable under present circumstances to have your money invested in China. You may not think you do. If you have money in the stock market, you almost certainly have some of it tucked away in Chinese companies, because that's what people Bill used to work with think is warranted in terms of perhaps your best interests, but certainly theirs. And Bill, one of the companies that has been back in the news a bit is Alibaba, a major Chinese conglomerate that specializes in e-commerce and technology and the like. It's had a rough road over the past few years. Remind us why that is and whether that ought to be a tell for people thinking about investing in it or having their money invested by others in it.
Well, Alibaba was the creation of Jack Ma, who became the wealthiest of the wealthy among the roughly 1,000 or so Chinese billionaires. And the Chinese Communist Party thought Jack was getting a little too visible, a little too cocky. And so
uppity.
They bought, what's that?
Uppity.
Uppity? Okay, yeah. Uppity.
he was you know, challenging the party.
I'll take uppity. Yeah, he was uppity anyway. So he's now downity.
He's been downity for a while.
They disappeared.
As has his company. Yeah,
they disappeared him for about two and a half, three years, and now he's back. And he's back with a plan to break Alibaba up into six pieces. So that you can more freely trade the pieces of the conglomerate. Now, there's an old-fashioned financial explanation for that, which is the markets do not like holding companies, and there are big discounts on companies that own lots of disparate businesses. So by breaking it up, theoretically, you could free up that value, and consequently, Alibaba went up about 18% last week. It's probably not a buy now. I don't think it's a buy ever, really, for American investors, because as I've warned in the past, the rules for American investors are not good if you're investing in China. And one of the ways to think about that is what the big guys are doing. You know, you look at what's happening with American multinationals, American-based or even European-based multinationals. They're getting very wary about setting up new operations in China. And Japan, which has had a lot of relationships and investments in China, is also pulling back on their investing. It'll take a long time for people to pull completely out, but for every new dollar that's being invested around the world in manufacturing or development is not going into China right now, because I think people have woken up to the strategic risk.
Well, they are real, and I don't know that they're being adequately disclosed to small investors in the United States, pension funds, and so on.
I think I mentioned this last time, Frank. The Chinese held their big investment conference welcoming the world into China. Well, that used to be attended by virtually every CEO of multinationals and hedge funds and investment firms. And this last time, I think we only had two, Ray Dalio and Tim Cook from Ray Dalio of Bridgewater and Tim Cook of Apple show up. The rest were not there, and I think that speaks volumes.
Well, and those two are pretty wholly owned subsidiaries of the Chinese Communist Party, it seems, at the moment. Bill, let me turn to another topic that I think is on all of our minds. I talked a little bit about a related point with George Raisley a short while ago, but I'd like to get your take on it. These Chinese Communist Party-controlled apps, as they're called, applications for cell phones and the like. TikTok, most prominently of late, but it's not the only one. In fact, CNN reported recently that this outfit called Pinduoduo, which is a sort of shopping channel, and it's American affiliate Temu, apparently, has been making inroads into this country as well. And according to CNN, like TikTok, one of the beneficiaries of all of this is, surprise, surprise, the Chinese Communist Party and its ability to hoover up data. including, we're told by, I think, six different cyber experts around the world, using malware that apparently is extremely formidable and dangerous, grabbing everything that's on your phone and, you know, remaining there indefinitely. I don't know whether you're up to speed on any of this, but I just wondered, to the extent, again, that we're seeing evidence of the malign intent of the Chinese Communist Party, shouldn't it further encourage us to be disengaging massively from it and its operation?
Well, there's the privacy aspect, which is real. And if we think they're mining our data, they are. And it all ends up back in Beijing. And they do have artificial intelligence monitoring everything to look for trends and patterns and how they can use it strategically. That's happening. The other thing to keep in mind is that Chinese are very aware of behavior modification. And it speaks volumes that the Chinese would not let the U.S. version of TikTok into China. In China, they use some version of TikTok that basically promotes state-approved behavior. And in here, there's lots of evidence that China is using TikTok to promote things like joining anti-fob or
hating the country.
Or just generally hating the country. It's a very, very negative. Now, if you're watching cat videos, I don't watch TikTok, but I've seen a few clips, but you know, it's addictive and you get drawn in and your unconscious is being worked on here. And, you know, remember the old days of the Manchurian candidate and the brainwashing back from China, Korea. Well, that's still very much part of their culture. And they use TikTok as a tool to do just that. So this idea that we're going to be promoting free speech by allowing TikTok in America is naive beyond imagination. It's sort of like, it's naive in the way I used to be naive, and I believed in unrestricted free trade with China before I met this guy, Frank Gaffney.
You've come a long way, baby. Well, we're very appreciative. I wish I could take credit for it, Bill, but you've become a formidable champion of America first, and we're delighted to have you with us always. God bless you. We'll talk with you next week. We'll talk with the rest of you next time on Securing America. Until then, go forth and multiply.